Please the court. My name is Lawrence Anderson. I represent the appellant, Jorge Alberto Escobar Valladares. I may refer to Mr. Valladares as Mr. Escobar because that's how I met him as a client when we took out our representation. I apologize for any confusion that may cause. I would also ask to reserve 5 minutes at the end for any potential rebuttal. In essence, I believe this appeal comes down to asking the question of whether we've complied with Virginia Rule 1.4, I believe it is. The complaint must contain adequate allegations to properly apprise the defendant of sufficient information to inform him of the nature of the claims against the defendant. And I believe we've done that. I also believe that the trial court, in the process of hearing the argument on the motion for the demurrers, made factual findings that need to be addressed at trial. For instance, clearly we both alleged the creation of a duty of an attorney-client relationship in paragraphs 8, 9, and 25 of our complaint. And specifically in paragraph 25, we've alleged that Escobar, relying upon the advice of Wells, retained Lillian Wells to file a bankruptcy on his behalf and paid $2,000 to the law firm on the same day, and was told by the defendants exactly what he would obtain from entering into this agreement with them, namely, to stop a foreclosure sale, surrender commercial property he had been trying to sell, and admitted by the defendants themselves retaining $200,000 of life insurance.
Let me get that straight. That $200,000 is not the face value of the policy. That's his cash surrender value.
Correct, Your Honor. There are two cash assets that have to be surrendered in this case. There's a bank account of approximately $27,000 and a cash value life insurance policy of $200,000.
That's what I understood. I just want to make sure because other people seem to be talking about it like they weren't quite sure they understood what it meant.
It is in essence a bank account. It is cash. You can go borrow against it. You can take it out and withdraw it. It generates dividends.
He can give it to the trustee, unfortunately.
He can give it to the trustee.
Okay.
I believe we've alleged a duty under the common law of Virginia in the case of Musselman versus Willoughby, as cited in our papers. In essence, the duty of a Virginia attorney must disclose anything known to him or her that might affect the client's decision on whether or how to act. And the attorney must disclose to the client information necessary to enable the client to understand provisions that have the potential for affecting the client adversely. And that, to me, is, in essence, what is specifically in the complaint, which is part of the Bankruptcy Code as the recodification of it of the 2005 Act, known as BAPSIPA, the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act, that there is a consumer protection portion incorporated into the new code, and that is found in 11 U.S.C. 526A3. Where the Bankruptcy Code goes on to define what's called a debt relief agency. Now, a debt relief agency is an attorney who files bankruptcy for consumers with the general public. I don't believe yet any dispute whether or not the Lilly Law Group or Attorney Wells was a debt relief agency. And it goes on to say that a debt relief agency shall not misrepresent to any assisted person or a prospective assisted person, directly or indirectly, affirmatively or by material omission with respect to, subparagraph B, the benefits and risks that may result if such person becomes a debtor in a case under this title. And we've alleged in paragraph 16 of the complaint that the defendants failed to properly analyze Mr. Escobar's financial situation and the legal alternatives to commencing a Chapter 7 petition. Without properly analyzing the effects of Chapter 7, the defendants incompetently advised Mr. Escobar that his only option was to file Chapter 7 and that he would be able to keep his non-exempt assets and his real properties. This advice was completely incorrect and caused actual economic damage to Mr. Escobar's interests, including but not limited to losing his $227,000 cash and cash equivalents, and created further financial jeopardy to his property interests, because he no longer had the ability to utilize his cash and cash equivalents to reorganize his assets and his debts. Further, we've alleged in paragraph 19 of the complaint, found in the joint appendix at page 121, that the defendant admits that they fully understood that Mr. Escobar did not want to lose his $200,000 cash value policy at the meeting of creditors and still had time, had they acted as a reasonably competent lawyer, to obtain this goal by converting the case to a prior to the foreclosure on the 9816-9818 Liberia Avenue property in Manassas. The defendants continued to fail to honor the client's wishes and promises they made to Escobar because the defendants did not understand that their promises were not possible. Previously in the complaint, we've alleged that they specifically advised him that he would not lose this cash or the cash value life insurance policy. The line continues, this is because the defendants did not understand bankruptcy law relative to this issue, as is evidenced by the trustee's motion and the email from the defendants. And this is an important aspect of the bankruptcy code. It is a nuance of bankruptcy. Had there been no proofs of claim filed, had there been the creditors not come in with the deficiency claim, which the lawyer caused, then yes, he would have gotten the cash back. He would have only had to pay $30,000 to his unsecured creditors and been free to go on his way. However, since they put him into bankruptcy, they foreclosed on the property, the lawyer created the deficiency claim, and now they're saying that was the client's fault.
Did the lawyer create the deficiency claim, or did the lawyer just not advise him of that risk, which is a very great risk as it occurred in this case?
I think really the lawyer didn't advise him that, in essence, by going into Chapter 7, you, in essence, lose control of the property. It all goes to the trustee. The trustee's job is then to sort it out. Do I sell this? Do I sell that? What claims have to be paid? And in a situation where there's a surplus of property, the trustee can allow late filed claims.
But in other words, they didn't cause the deficiency or cause the deficiency to occur other than by advising him to let that go to foreclosure. It just happened as a result of that's what happens in bankruptcy.
It can happen in bankruptcy. And in this case, by advising him to go into the bankruptcy and then allowing the property to go to foreclosure, the trustee then brought in this claim.
Right.
Which then had to be paid, and therefore he lost control of the property. And therein is another aspect of the negligent advice, failing to advise of the material adverse consequence. And I think in the joint appendix at page 75, in the motion filed by the trustee and in the agreement that was made with the trustee to try to help Mr. Escobar minimize the impacts here, was that the trustee abandoned his interest in any other property of the debtor or the bankruptcy estate, including the debtor's potential malpractice claims. A decision was made to not convert the case to Chapter 11. And that was part of the compromise, and it is in the papers, it's in the trustee's motion, it's in the opposition. What's not part of the record was the actual hearing, but it was a compromise that was made by the debtor and the trustee to allow the trustee to settle the case and allow us to go forward in state court.
But the key part is that doesn't mean he wasn't damaged. That was something he did to minimize his damages.
I believe that is, Your Honor. I believe that is something that we agreed at the bankruptcy court level with the trustee was an effort to minimize and mitigate damages, to let that happen and then pursue remedies in state court. I believe that the trial court in this regard committed a reversible error when it found against the allegations in the complaint, where specifically I had argued to the trial court about whether or not the cash value assets was non-exempt or what it was. But I had asked the court, what document did he sign that told him what his non-exempt property was? But I believe we have alleged that they didn't tell him what his non-exempt property was, and the court specifically found that that's not their duty. And I would ask this court, the same question I asked the trial court, is if it's not the lawyer's duty to advise his client as to what property that client has, to take the whole picture of that client and say, if you file bankruptcy, you have to be aware that specifically that property you're telling me that you want to keep is or is not exempt, not just give a notice that's prepared by the clerk's office to say, bankruptcy can be very costly, bankruptcy can be very dangerous, bankruptcy can have a lot of ramifications, you should seek counsel before you file that voluntary petition. That's what we've alleged, that they did not specifically alert the client that cash value was at risk.
Well, in addition to that, it seems to me that the trial court went one step further beyond that. I'm not contesting anything you just said, but he went one step further to dismiss on demur this case because she said that he wasn't in any worse situation than he would have been if he hadn't, because the debts were there, the assets were there, there's nothing different about them. I see in paragraph 63 that you're allege that the loss of liquidity by itself is a damage, and also you have a litany of other things, damages including accruing interest on life insurance value of the loan, loss of accrued cash, surrender value, loss of self-paid premiums, damage to his credit, loss of taxably beneficial practices, and attorney's fees. But it seems to me that the trial judge actually went one step further than what you just argued and said you weren't even damaged one way or the other.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the trial judge did go a step further and make factual determinations that damages had not occurred when we had alleged damages had occurred, and those are specifically the damages.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure both of those issues were on the table before your opposing parties got up.
Yes, Your Honor. I will reserve the rest of my time at this moment. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Please, the court. Danny Howell on behalf of the appellees, Mr. Wells, and the Lilly Law Firm, where it alleged in the amended complaint that had Mr. Escobar been advised with respect to risks, he would not have filed a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. In fact, it's alleged that he may well have done it. It is alleged that he may have been considering five other options, including doing nothing. But the first stage of the effect of the attorney's advice, there's no allegation that he would have done anything differently. And that's of some significance. Before we even reach the issue of whether or not at the end of the day, he in fact has alleged that he's worse off, and he most definitely has not been alleged. He has never alleged that the impact of insistent negligence was to cause him to do something that he wouldn't have otherwise done. In this instance, we know, because the documents the court was able to consider, what Mr. Escobar's financial position was going in and what it was coming out. There was a deficiency from a foreclosure. If he'd never filed bankruptcy, presumably there would have been a deficiency from a foreclosure sale and a proof of claim of $500,000 about. He had $1.7 million in equity in his real property, and at the end of the day, he lost $230,000 in cash and received a personal discharge of $500,000 in personal liability. If he had kept the $200,000, he would have gone through his settlement, gotten a discharge, and paid nothing other than the attorneys. If he hadn't gone in bankruptcy, purely speculative whether he would have had damage to his creditor rating, whether he would have paid attorney's fees, as he said to his own wife, well, might have, with respect to other alternatives. What, at the end of the day, is the proximate cause test in a bankruptcy-based legal malpractice case? We know from Hendricks v. Dougherty what the test is, and the lost cause of action, a lost lawsuit, is statute of limitations. No, I think, from Count versus Betty's, that at least as a matter of proof, causation in a settlement case requires a showing that but for the attorney's advice, the plaintiff, the client, would have been better off, would have achieved a set of financial goals that were superior. In this case, it is never alleged that at the end of the day, Mr. Escobar would have been better off financially. There are damages that proof would be offered. There's no allegation that he would have been better off. In fact, the allegations as set forth would indicate that he, in fact, was not worse off. And the various range of options that are given all contain risks. Ultimately, proximate causation does not marry well with the words could have, might have, if, perhaps, possible. And in this particular pleading, there is no allegation that he would have been worse off, and there is no allegation that he would have done something different.
What about paragraphs 61 and 63, where he essentially says, I would have had liquidity, and I would have been able to retain my assets? He apparently has an extra witness that's going to come in and explain to the court how that would have happened.
He would have had $250,000. At the end of the day, would he have had that $200,000 anyway, facing a foreclosure on his home?
That's what he's alleged, though. Are you talking about proof or are you talking about allegations?
He has alleged he would have been better off. He says, I would have kept the assets I wanted to keep. We all in bankruptcy might like to keep certain assets, but the purpose of a liquidation under Chapter 7 is to leave us in as best a financial picture as possible. There was no guarantee, and there was no promise that the asset would be kept. Instead, there was a contract that said exactly the opposite. There was no promise that the trustee would not sell property. Instead, there was a required statutory disclosure, part of the current laws in bankruptcy, that the trustee had the power to do that.
Let me ask you this question. Is it the contested issue as to whether or not your client advised him that he would lose that $200,000 cash surrender that he had in the life insurance policy?
Nothing is contested because we're on demur. All the facts are assumed to be true, obviously.
Did you? Oh, you just, all you played was demur, nothing else. Okay.
No, there's nothing else. Demur happened to consider documents because both counsels stood.
So that's a fact that we deal with right now at this stage.
That's an allegation that the court assumes to be true. Okay. That he was advised that he would keep it.
Right.
That, I would say, is distinct from a promise that he would keep it or a guarantee.
How do you see that?
I predict that my client will win their case. They will be successful. They will recover $500,000 in damages. My prediction is not a guarantee. It is my view as to the outcome. Is there a risk? I would inform my client of the risk. This client, we know from the pleadings, we're not dealing with facts and what really happened based on the truth. We're dealing with the pleadings. We know that this client was so advised, he was required to sign a document in bankruptcy showing that he had read this. And he signed a separate document with a lawyer showing he had read this.
Well, you're talking about evidence now. At demur, we're talking about allegations. I mean, what you're saying is that he's going to have a hard time proving his case. You might be right. The question is, did he plead his case?
The question that I ask the court is, what does it mean when the trial court can consider documents that counsel has agreed it may review? What does it mean when the court can consider documents properly judicially noticed?
But his argument is not that I didn't have the document that told me my non-exempt property might be at risk. His argument is they didn't define for me what the non-exempt property is, so I couldn't make an informed decision.
You know,
there's a difference between I have a document
I'm sorry, and
I'm advised as to what that document means.
I would respond in this fashion. We live in a world of contracts, of insurance policies, of agreements about financial matters, and we sign them. And we are held as a duty to have read them. And that duty
it's not about whether he read it, is it, counsel? It's about whether the lawyer that he hired to advise him told him or defined for him what is non-exempt property. Your $200 sitting in your insurance property may become non-exempt property if this other property is foreclosed on. Isn't that his allegation?
His argument is that there's a duty to advise. And the facts before the court that it could assume is true were that, in fact, he did read something that contained that advice. If he didn't understand it, if I don't understand a contract before I sign it, I'm obligated to ask. But the question I would ask next is, what would he have done differently if he were so advised? He expressly tells the court in his pleading, if I were so advised to go forward with a 7, then the attorney should have simply had me sign a disclosure showing that I had received this information. Nowhere is any defendant told that their duty was not to put an end to a Chapter 7. Bankruptcy is a world of options, and if it is malpractice to go forward and recommend a particular option, we ought to know it. To this day, we don't know it. Was it malpractice not to put him into a Chapter 11? It's not alleged. Instead, he should have discussed it as well as alleged. One of the things he should have discussed is the notion that he should do nothing and allow the home to go to foreclosure. Was that a duty to do that? The complaint doesn't say. And the complaint needs to say if we are set saying that we have played prima facie case. Otherwise, we merely have a number of speculative options and a lawyer who is required somehow to do something based on them without an expression of duty. These days, attorneys, especially in bankruptcy, are dealing with a number of complex issues, and those complexities are before them based on the facts. In this case, the particular facts were the man's house was going to be foreclosed on at 9 next morning. He had certain properties which he had substantial amount of equity that he didn't want to be sold. Those properties were not sold over the attempts of the Chapter 7 trustee to sell them. In exchange for discharge, he paid money. And again, the trial court did focus on the notion that no attorney is required to guarantee or achieve a perfect result. Keeping the $200,000 would have been a perfect result.
Let me ask you this question. There's 63 paragraphs in this complaint. If the 64th paragraph said, because of the defendant's negligence, but for the defendant's negligence, I would not have filed a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Would that, in your judgment, make this pleading sufficient to withstand a demur?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you tell me the paragraph again?
That's the 64th paragraph.
There are two parts.
You're asking, show me in here where he said he wouldn't have filed bankruptcy. I don't necessarily see the specific line that says that, but I see an awful lot of lines that certainly imply it. There are but four lines, and they're all over the place. So let's add one more paragraph, and he actually says it. But for their negligence, I would not have declared Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Then is it still defective?
Can we take one step back and ask where the complaint says that there was a duty not to put him in? If there was no duty and it's not alleged, then whether he would or wouldn't is
I can't speak for my colleagues, but there's duty all over this complaint. So why don't you answer my question?
Your question, the response is, if it was alleged that he wouldn't have gone into a 7, then that's the first stage. That's not a whole ball of wax. The rest of it is, was he worse off? If the court decides not to accept that as a test in this type of a situation, then what is the test? What is the test outside of a lost cause of action?
Well, now, you obviously don't believe that loss of liquidity is a damage.
A net gain is not a damage. Based on various issues.
You have to listen to my questions in order to get the answer.
Yes, sir.
My question is, do you believe that a loss of liquidity is, in fact, a damage?
Your Honor, I believe it in an isolated world. I don't believe it in this case.
Well, see, that's the problem. See, that's exactly what the problem is with this case. You're talking about evidence, and demurs talk about allegations. So in this case, you may very well, at the end of the day, have a resounding victory. But we have to look at these pleadings and decide whether or not he gets to try. That's the difference. You might be right about it. But the question is, on these pleadings, has he stated a claim?
May I offer one other
response? Absolutely, sure.
When we're talking about proximate causation, inference based on uncertainty should not be sufficient as a matter of law. And in this case, what I think this complaint is filled with is a variety of options.
What?
A variety of options. Not one allegation of a particular duty. And again, this is it's been argued this is a transactional case. I don't know whether that's right or not. Bankruptcy seems to be a mix of several things. But assuming it's like a settlement, at the end of the day, one pays money for selling. One gets certain things in return. What at the end is the test as to whether one is worse off? Is the test at all that one is worse off? I don't know what it is if that's not what it is.
I want to see if I understand your position. With regard to the proximate cause in a legal malpractice case where the underlying question is a malpractice with regard to bankruptcy and advising about bankruptcy, is it, if I understand you correctly, your position that the cause of action and the elements of the cause of action that must be alleged is that, with regard to proximate cause, that but for the, in this case, alleged inappropriate or bad advice, I would not have filed Chapter 7, and if I had not filed, I would be, you say, better off. Is that what you view as the elements?
I think that there are two separate aspects of proximate causation. If the advice is not given or is given to file a 7 and the client would have done it anyway, we never get any farther than that.
Yeah, but so I understand that you're saying he needs to allege that but for the bad advice he would not have filed.
I think he has not alleged that.
Okay, but the second prong.
Right.
What do you say that is?
This, I think, is the same as saying the second prong in Hendricks versus Dougherty of a lost cause of action. I had a cause of action, and it was lost, meaning I would have gone forward with my suit. Certainly, if I didn't plead, that I didn't have a suit that I was going to bring. That wouldn't even get me to the next question. The next question is whether it made any difference. In this case, the next question is, would it have made a difference? And the only thing unusual here with respect to
the thing is what I'm asking you, you're alleging that proximate cause in this type of case are allegations that, but for the bad advice, I would not have filed, and if I had not filed, I would be in a better financial position than I am in.
No, if I did file, I'm in a better position. If I wasn't, then I haven't established proximate cause. You know, if I was in better shape, I haven't established proximate causation. I have to be worse off. What's the difference in a settlement versus this case? In Campbell versus Bettius, it was a settlement and advice that was wrong. There would still be the ability to pursue a guarantor for the other 20% of the 100% of the value of the loan.
Well, he does allege that he lost this liquidity, that he apparently, at least alleged, that he told his attorney was what he wanted to accomplish. That was one of his goals. And so he does allege that he lost that.
He alleges that he lost this particular goal. He didn't allege that his goal with respect to bankruptcy was, I want to be possession of this asset, even if it means that I'm worse off. He was stopping a foreclosure on his home. There were various goals. He does allege, I would have had this $200,000, and it meant a lot to me. This was important to me, to keep this $200,000. But is that the test with respect to a particular asset when he's warned it could be lost? And even irrespective of that, when we're talking about a liquidation, what do we do in a liquidation? We have it done. And in this case,
you've answered my question. Thank you. Your time's expired.
Thank you very much.
In your answer to her question, you used the word established. And I might add, that's the word the trial judge used. But that's a word of proof, not an allegation.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
Rebuttal?
Please, the court. The arguments seem to be focused on whether he was worse off or better off. And I think that we have alleged that the...
Let me ask this counsel. Who gets to decide whether he's better off or worse off?
I think the jury.
Does the lawyer get to decide, or does your client get to decide?
Well, Your Honor, I think that we've alleged that he's entitled to be placed in the position he would have occupied but for the malpractice. If we can establish the elements of the malpractice claim, which I've gone through, that the court short-circuited the evidentiary process of letting us establish the facts to prove where he would have been but for their negligence. And we allege that in paragraph 17, paragraph 63, as Your Honors have found, and I would also add paragraphs 54, 55, and 56. At this time, I have no further argument. Any questions?
All right. The court will take a short recess.
All right.